to relate all of the what has gone before, and it is necessary to understand these things as they are related to one another. And so if you haven't heard the past, it may be a little more difficult as we go along to pick up the threads of thought. But we're still early enough in the study so that it will be possible, I think, for us to relate the matters one to the other. To start off with, I think that it would be in order to just ask a few review questions concerning our study last time. Our study started off in what place? Where were we in vision? Who remembers? Yes, Revelation 12. Where were we?
We were in vision. We were in the heavenly realm. This is the picture of the dragon and the woman and the stars and the sun glows in the thundering wind on the feet. And we were in the ecclesiastical or spiritual heavenly ruling power of our realm.
That's right. This vision started off in heaven. And we saw a woman there, clothed with the sun, the crown on her head, 12 stars, and so on. And then we also saw a dragon, and he too was in heaven. This dragon that we saw had 7 heads and had 7 crowns upon its heads, and I think for this we should turn in the picture here to help relate what we saw last time. This is the dragon that we were considering last week. And this dragon, we observed, had something phenomenal about it. Being a phenomenal beast anyway, but more than in the ordinary, out of being, more than being dreadful, what did it have on its head? Crown, that's right. And it had 7 heads, and it had 7 crowns. And what did we understand these heads represented? Well, first, what did the dragon represent that we discussed?
Civil powers.
Yes, the civil powers of the Roman Empire. We might add that. Not just any civil powers, but of the Roman Empire. And those 7 heads show what in this Roman Empire? Yes, it shows that there were 7 stages or 7 successions of government within the Roman Empire. The beast, you see, pictures the Roman Empire, and each head shows one particular phase of the Roman Empire, and it went through 7 different phases, if you please. Alright, and then we learned about this dragon that had a tail that drew the 3rd part of the stars of heaven. And it cast into the earth. And who did we conclude the 3rd part of the stars of heaven to represent? This is just a review.
Right-hearted?
Yes, we understood it to represent the right-hearted bishops and so on in the church. We wanted to take the time. I had some quotations here in the 2nd volume that but I don't know if we better go back into the 12th chapter. We could spend another hour or two on it. But maybe after the meeting or sometime, like if anyone wants these quotations, we can refer you to them. Alright, it represents the right-hearted in the spiritual realm that were depoled as events developed in the church, in the ecclesiastical realm. And of course then what happened to the dragon after the man-child was born? Remember, the dragon was in heaven. What happened to the dragon when the man-child was caught up to God and to his throne? Yes, the dragon was on the earth where we here see him. And not only was the dragon back on the earth, where he belongs. But who else did we find in the earth? Who was with the, who finally was with this dragon, or not related to it, but also who was in the heaven, who later we find in the earth? Well, his angels were cast out with him, but what about the woman? We find her in the wilderness, don't we? Not in the wilderness of heaven so much, but in the wilderness of earth, where Elijah was. And for a similar period of time, for 1260 years. And we finished, we followed this matter through in considerable detail, which we can't go into at this time, but we finished with the dragon in what mood? What was the last thought with regard to this dragon? Yes, he was in a nasty mood. He was angry with the woman, and the account said that he was going to make war with the remnant of this woman's seed. That's where the chapter ends. But that isn't the end of the dragon, and that isn't the end of the woman or her seed. But that's the end of the 12th chapter. We pick up these events later, and they're all related one to the other. You see, this 12th chapter doesn't finish the story. It only takes you, it's like a kind of like a serial, you know. It leaves you in an exciting point where the dragon is angry and he's going to make war with the remnant of her seed, and that's where the 12th chapter ends. It doesn't say any more. And we'll pick up this story later on when we begin to tie the visions together. But now we're interested in another beast, and we'll turn off this beast so we don't get confused. Today, our lesson is along a different line. Another beast. Now, I don't know where I could put this where we could all see it without me having to hold it all the time. Can everyone see this? I don't think I can say anything. Well, I'll hold it for the time being. I'll hold it for the time being until we get familiar with the lesson of our, the picture of our study. I think, first of all, before we start discussing this matter, we should read a little bit about the description of this beast, and as we read it, keep checking back and see how accurate we have this vision portrayed to us. Who will read the first two verses of Revelation 13. Sister Lillian, do you have it there, please?
And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his feet, and greater authority.
Yes. All right, now here is the description of this beast, and I think the artist did a very good job in giving us a detailed picture of this beast. Notice it says, but there was a combination, really, of three beasts. And these three beasts are not unfamiliar beasts in the scriptures. These three beasts, all of them, have a scriptural background. It's just not some beast that's the first time we hear of them in the Bible. But these three beasts had prominent mentions in the book of Daniel. Now, the first of these beasts was like what? I mean that it's likened to. Apparently, it was the most spectacular thing about this beast. In other words, I think John listed this in the way that it impressed him. The first thing he noticed, there was something about this, and he listed first. Yes, it was like a leopard. The body of the beast was like a leopard. It had spots like a leopard and so on. And perhaps had a shape very much like a leopard. All right? Does anyone remember a leopard in the Old Testament?
Greece was represented by a leopard in Daniel.
That's right. In the 7th chapter of Daniel, you'll find there that Greece was represented by a leopard. So this animal had some similarity to Greece, to the Grecian Empire. All right, then the next element, it had the feet of a bear. Any animal in the Old Testament that was given specific mention? Yes, Medo-Persia was represented by a bear. And this particular beast had feet like a bear. And that, you know, the feet of a bear are the most unusual thing about the animal. They're almost like human hands, except for the fact that they don't have the human wrist and thumb, but they use their paw, as it were, very much like we use our hand. Not only for walking, but they use it to feed themselves and catch things with it, or reach in tree trunks, you know, and get honey and catch fish with it. It's very versatile. It's more like a hand than it is a paw, which is unique. You see, this animal is a unique animal. All right? It had a similarity to the Medo-Persian Empire. And also, the last beast that had the mouth of what? A lion. Now we see all these things represented here. The Babylonian Empire was represented by a lion in Daniel. And the whole beast, you know, there was a fourth beast in Daniel that was exceeding dreadful, terrible. And does that remind you of this beast in any way? This is a dreadful beast. In other words, this shows us a government, something that has all the background of the four universal empires within it. All the subtlety, all the craft, all the hiddenness. So, for instance, the spots of a leopard, which makes it camouflage, hard to see. It's hard to tell when a leopard is on the scene because of that unique camouflage that they have. They can be standing almost on top of you, and you can't hardly see them until they move. And then the feet of a bear. I remember Medo-Persia, when they marched in under the gates of the city of Babylon, it's almost like a bear reaching under the gates and getting the populace there within the city. Well, this beast had all that subtlety too, raspingness. And then it had the mouth of a lion. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, he was lifted up, he spoke great, swelling things about himself. Well, this lion's mouth was on this beast too. And on top of this, how many crowns did this beast have, and where are they located?
And crowns were located on
the head. Yes, on the horn. That's right, it has 10 crowns. Now, how many, 7 from 10 makes how many difference? In other words, the beast we saw here, the dragon, had how many crowns? It had 7. This has 10. There's 3 crowns differentiation. And there's a difference in where these crowns are placed. The dragon that we discussed last week, the crown's on its head. This has the crowns on its horns. Now, these are all, the only thing that's similar about this beast and the dragon is what? Yeah, that's about it. The only similarity between them is the 7 heads. They all had 7 heads, which identifies to our minds what? What would we conclude if they all the beasts, there are 3 beasts in Revelation that have 7 heads. And what would we conclude?
Same powers?
Well, yes, they had in a way same powers. That isn't so much the thought, I don't think, but they fit into what? Isn't it the same time element? They each fit into the 7 stages of the Roman Empire. That's a thought I think we can gather from the seven heads, but that's the only similarity. We see great differences. Now, first of all, there is a discrepancy here, and these are discrepancies that they're not really discrepancies. They're things that come up in the scriptures that will either prevent us from making a conclusion or show us the conclusion that we have already made is wrong, or else it'll guide us in making a better conclusion, a clearer conclusion, and identifying the things that are to come. Now, for instance, what I'm getting at, this may sound confusing, but in the last chapter that we studied, in Revelation, the 12th chapter, we found that the dragon made war with Michael. And who was Michael in that instance? Well, yes, it represented the man of sin, particularly. And that would include the Pope. That's when it became really the, in the highest sense of the word, although in other stages it could be referred to as a man of sin even before that. But when the church finally accepted an earthly head, that's when Brother Up said it became the man of sin. Up till then, the picture of a woman is used. But when they accept an earthly headship, then they become the man of sin. Just like we, the church, are pictured by a woman until we are joined with Christ in holy matrimony, and then it is shown as the Christ's body, which is masculine, and we are pictured in that. All right, there was war in heaven, though. The dragon wasn't willing to give the man of sin the complete run of the heavens, was he? According to the Revelation, the 12th chapter. There was a war in heaven about who was to have the control of the heavens. And who lost the war?
The dragon.
The dragon lost it. The dragon was cast out of heaven. He was cast out of the spiritual realm. In other words, when Constantine entered the church, he entered it as the Pontifex Maximus. And he was the one that called the Council of Nicaea, and it was he that finally decided, or had the bishops decide with him, what was the proper conclusion of the matters, and which way the official position of the church was going to be. But you see, that didn't continue indefinitely. It wasn't for an indefinite period where the emperors lay down the law in the church, in the spiritual realm, as to what was right and what was wrong. That position was soon lost by the civil powers, by the dragon. And the ecclesiastical realm, the Pope, and the ones from within the church gained control of the heavens. And they cast the civil power out of the voice of authority in the heavens. And I think that was our conclusion from our last study. But now here, you'll notice a complete reversal. In this picture, we see the dragon, instead of making war with with Michael, which we say was the man of sin, why, he turns around and he says, well, here's the thief, and he gives him his power, and he gives him great authority, and everyone marvels at this. Now, apparently a contradiction. Revelation, the 12th chapter, there was a war in heaven about Michael getting a place there, a throne in heaven. And even the dragon lost it. He didn't give it. He lost it. He lost the war and he landed up on earth. But this account shows that the dragon was willing, he was glad, he turned around and gave his seat and his great authority unto the beast. Well, we didn't read that part, but we better read it now. Verses 3-7. Will somebody read that, please? Well, we did read that in the first, and the dragon. Yeah, the second verse, we did read that part. Well, that's all right. We'll read the next three verses, too. Will somebody read that? volunteers, not real draft people. All right, thank you.
As it were wounded, dead, and her deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemy. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth and blasphemed against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and then dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations.
Yes. Now, here is the explanation, the secret of this seemingly contradictory proposition. See, if we were wrong in our conclusion, in our last lesson, it would come right up here. We either were dead wrong in concluding that the Michael there represented the man of sin, or else we've got to qualify this chapter in another sense. And we're unwilling to conclude that we were wrong, because we were satisfied with the lessons that we gathered from here that it was right, that this man-child that was caught up to God in his throne did represent the man of sin. But this is no contradiction whatever. This shows a different proposition entirely. This is talking, where is this vision? Where is the setting of this vision to start with? Is it in heaven or in earth? The 13th chapter. Where do we get the picture? Yes. It's not talking about heaven. It's not talking about the controversy between the emperors and the bishops as to who is to be the big fish in the pond and who is to decide the issues in the church and create the dogmas in the church. This is on an earthly plane. This shows the Roman Catholic system, not so much as a church, but as a government in the civil world, on the earthly plane. It rolls up out of the sea, and stood upon the sand of the seashore. It's not a heavenly picture. It's not talking about the ecclesiastical ground at all. You see? And this, I think, is an important part. But once we do see this distinction, why, it helps us to understand in what respect are we to consider this dragon, or this leopard-like beast. We're to consider it as a government. While it has spiritual aspects to it, there's no doubt, you can't entirely separate the man of sin from it, but we must think of it, this picture, as showing the Roman Catholic system as a government, as a power in the Roman Empire, in the civil part of the Roman Empire. And in that respect, we find that the emperors were glad to give the church seat and great authority. In the second volume, we have, many quotations here, but we'll refer to a few to show that it's the papacy evolving into the civil powers of the earth that is here referred to. On page 293 of the second volume, we quote, it says, thus under Constantine's reign, all hindrance was finally removed, and as we shall find, the organization of the papacy and the church nominal under the headship of the Bishop of Rome as Pope was speedily effected. And on page 297, Brother Russell quotes from a Catholic writer to show the rise of the papacy in temporal power, that is, in the earthly sense. And here's what we read. I'll read the paragraph that introduces the paragraph so you get the setting. Bob Russell says that a Roman Catholic writer fully corroborates our findings on this subject. And we present his words, regardless of their gloss, as corroborative testimony, giving with glowing enthusiasm a description of the rise of the papacy to temple power, describing it as a plant of heavenly origin and therefore of rapid growth and high exaltation in the world, he says. We quote. This is a Roman Catholic historian. He says, the rise of the temple power of the Pope. Now, we're not talking about the ecclesiastical power. Now, this is the temple power in the civil realm and the earth that our picture is concerned with. The rise of the temporal power of the Pope presents to the mind one of the most extraordinary phenomena which the annals of the human race offer to our wonder and admiration. By a single combination of concurring circumstances, a new power and a new dominion grew up silently and steadily on the ruins of that Roman Empire which had extended its sway over or made itself respected by nearly all the nations, peoples, and races that lived in the period of its strength and glory, and that new power of lowly origin struck a deeper root and soon exercised a wider authority than the empire whose gigantic ruins it saw shivered into fragments and moldering in the dust. In Rome itself, the power of the successor of Peter grew side by side with and under the protecting shadow of that of the emperor. Notice. Who side by side and under the protecting shadow of the emperor. There you see is the dragon, giving him his seat and great authority. And such was the increasing influence of the Pope that the majesty of the supreme pontiff was likely ere long to dim the splendor of the purple, that is, of the emperor. The removal by constant heat of the seat of the empire from the west to the east, from the historic banks of the Tiber to the beautiful shores of the Bosphorus, laid the broad foundation of a sovereignty which in reality commences from that momentous change. Practically almost from that day, Rome, which had witnessed the birth, the youth, the splendor, and the decay of the mighty race by whom her name had been carried with her eagles to the remotest regions of the then known world, was gradually abandoned by the inheritors of her renown, and its people deserted by the emperors, an easy prey to the ravages of the barbarians, whom they had no longer the courage to resist, beheld the Bishop of Rome, their guardian, their protector, their father. Year by year, the temporal authority of the popes grew into shape and hardened into strength without violence, without bloodshed, without fraud, by the force of overwhelming circumstances, fashioned as if visibly by the hand of God. There we see, there's no contradiction in the picture. This picture shows the papacy as its rise as a government in the earth. And this account is true. It was, except for the part about being the hand of God, it was the hand of the God of this world. But this quietly, this leopard-like beast gradually gained greater renown than the emperors that wore the purple up to that time. So we see that this is a picture of the beast, as we are shown here, a picture of the Roman Catholic Church rising in temple power. And it reaches its peak and then continues how long? What does the account say? How long does this beast have power? 42 months. And how long was the woman in the wilderness? And what's the relationship? The same period of time. One was 1260 days. Now notice, while this beast is in the zenith of its power and glory, where is the woman? Same period of time. She's in the wilderness. Now you notice how accurate these pictures are. We see no contradiction, but we see that one is focusing the first vision started off in heaven. That accounts for the war there and the unwillingness of the emperor to lose control of the spiritual realm, which he ultimately did, and became strictly the realm of the Pope and his cardinals and his bishops and so on. He lost that. And the dragon, however, was willing and glad to give the Pope a seat in the temple government. And they did. Well, even before Constantine's time, remember in the second volume, Paul speaks of Paul of Samosata, the bishop in the time of Diocletian. He was so influential that he was receiving a fabulous sum, something like $77,000 a year in our money. An influential person in the state. And so, you see, the emperors were glad to, maybe you better just give you a brief snatch of some of this in the second volume, because sometimes it's hard to realize that these things are not in the volume, so that we're not presenting something that's out of the realm of the scripture study. Here, just this was even before Constantine gave official recognition to the papacy. This was under the terrible persecution of Diocletian. We think of the Christians as all being in such a bad way, but they weren't. Here's the story of Paul of Samosata, who filled a metropolitan see the bishopric of Antioch while the east was in the hands of old Danapus and Zenobia, and they serve to illustrate the condition and character of the time, about AD 270. Paul considered the service of the church a very lucrative profession. This is Paul of Samosata, not Paul the Apostle. His ecclesiastic jurisdiction was venal and rapacious. He exhorted frequent contributions from the most opulent of the faithful and converted to his own use a considerable part of the public revenue. It is claimed by critics as given that Paul held the office of imperial ducenarius, or procurator, with an annual salary of 200 sesteria, about 77,000. Well, that would be about three times that amount now in our deflated dollar. By his pride and luxury, the Christian religion was rendered odious in the eyes of the Gentiles. His council chamber and his throne, the splendor with which he appeared in the public, the suppliant crowd which solicited his attention, the multitude of letters and petitions to which he dictated his answers, the perpetual hurry of business in which he was involved, were circumstances which much better suited to the state of a civil magistrate than to the humility of a primitive bishop. When he harangued his people from the pulpit, Paul affected the figurative style and the theatrical gestures of an Asiatic sophist, while the cathedral resounded with the most extravagant acclamations in the praise of his divine eloquence. Against those who resisted his power or refused to flatter his vanity, the prelate of Antioch was arrogant, rigid, and inexorable, but he relaxed the discipline and lavished the treasures of the church on his dependent clergy. So you see that even before Constantine, there was a bid by the church for power. But it wasn't until Constantine's time that he finally, you know, when Constantine came to the throne, well, it tells us right in the second volume that there were six aspirants to the emperor's throne. And the Roman Empire was really in a shaky position. And it was Constantine who saw the possibilities of exploiting the church to strengthen his hand in the government. And that was a strategic move to make. As soon as he made his union with the state, then it was that Constantine, by giving a civil authority to the state and recognizing them as a state religion and so on, then it was that Constantine seated himself on the throne and rubbed out his other successors. Why, the year that he entered the church to show his insincerity was the same year that he had his own son, I guess, executed according to the second volume here. He was an unscrupulous politician, and he entered the church to gain its power, and he was willing to give the church power as long as it would uphold the throne, and it did just what he suggested. In the second volume, it shows how the bishops that met with him later with the emperor had those exiled and excommunicated and driven from their bishops, exiled, those that wouldn't go along with this new church-state arrangement. So you see, it was a clever move on his part. He was glad to give this beast seat and power and great authority. And that's what the account shows. That is, in the civil matter. Otherwise, we have a contradiction. In the religious realm, it wasn't just that way. It was just the opposite. Now, are there any questions up to this point? Any comments or anything that you just don't understand?
Brother Gene?
Brother Stewart?
In the second verse, you were talking about the three beasts in Daniel. You got Rome in there too. Just how did that fit? It's easy enough to see this, the three beasts that are named. And how did the fourth beast of Daniel fit in there?
Well, this is only, it doesn't say that. It's only my way of seeing it. You notice the sequence. It starts off with the last empire before it. That is, it was the Grecian Empire. And then it goes back to the Medo-Persian Empire, and then it goes back to the Babylonian. And it starts off with the beast itself, which was a terrible looking beast that Daniel, when he saw it, he didn't describe what it was. He just said it was exceeding dreadful. And so in that respect, this beast is dreadful like the civil aspects of the Roman Empire itself. Although this is the papal empire in the Roman picture. That is a point that maybe isn't well taken. I don't know. It's just a thought.
Would the ten horns fit them together too?
Well, in the Daniel's account, I don't think there were ten horns. It was, is there in the seventh chapter?
Yes, and then
yes,
the little horn came up later.
I thought it was three great horns that were plucked up, and then the one little horn that emerged.
Verse 7 ends up, it has 10 horns.
Oh yeah, well then there's an identifying feature which is related, that's right. But in that picture, of course, in Daniel, you see the papacy, this monstrous thing is shown by that little horn that cropped up, and it spoke great swelling things. But this is a separate picture, and it shows a detailed picture of this little horn, as it were, as a beast, as a power, as a government in temple affairs in the Roman Empire. I think that's what the picture conveys.
Did you touch on where it speaks of Christ saw one of the heads that were wounded to death?
Not yet. That I think we'll mention later. We've read that, but we didn't discuss all that we've read so far. Well, maybe we better get into that, unless there are some other questions that one might have, anyone might have at this time. Well, now we notice there's a differentiation here in the crown. This picture has 10 crowns, and the crowns are on the horn. What lesson do we think we could gather from this, if any?
Ten powers given,
Well, yes.
Vision of power.
Yes, and these crowns are really the crowns which the papacy would recognize. In other words, see, the papacy always felt this way about it. They didn't really recognize any emperors. Emperors, as far as they personally were concerned, were dust under their feet if they had their way. They couldn't say it just that way because they were usually powerful enough that they had a reckon with them. But the ones whom they claimed had a right to rule were the kings that they blessed, were the kings that they crowned, were the kings that the papacy chose to put into power. In other words, the papacy had a lot to do with these territorial governments within the Roman Empire, these littler kings, not the emperor over the whole empire, but under these territorial divisions. The papacy recognized the territorial divisions, but they did not recognize the headship of the emperor. I think that seems to be the thought. I don't know if I've made myself clear or not. It's kind of a difficult thing to explain. But there, we do see that there must be some, we do see that there is a difference here. There were seven crowns in the other picture, and they were upon the head in the rightful place where we would expect them to be, upon the governmental powers that were in authority. As each succession of government would come, they would have the right to rule, and from God's standpoint, it was really to be that way, that the powers were to be vested in the heads of these successive governments. Whereas this recognizes the kings that the papacy crowned and uncrowned. Those are the ones whom they claimed had a right to rule.
Yes.
Well, I think in some respects they're different pictures, but the territorial division is the thought of these ten horns. They represent the ten divisions in the Roman Empire, and the ten kings show that there were rulers within those territorial divisions, whereas the ten toes doesn't show you so much the kings involved, but it does show you the territorial division of the Roman Empire, which had their separate government. I think there would be a similarity in that respect. And they'd all fit into the same Roman picture. This is, all of these beasts really are concerned with the Roman picture, except maybe the image of the beast. Well, all right, we'll proceed. Now, the account tells us, after he saw this peculiar beast, that it had seven heads, and one of these heads was wounded, and it was almost unto death. I mean, they thought that would be the end of the beast, that one head should be wounded. Now, what wound do we believe was this that was inflicted upon one of the heads?
Reformation.
That's the thought that I think has followed the Bible students' world, and I think it's a correct one. Brother Russell, in the second or third volume, I believe it is, he relates this to the Reformation. He actually says in one place that the first 300 years of papacy's experiences shows her rise to power, and the last 300 years shows her decline in power. Starting with the Reformation, we see the wound that was received upon the head. And that wound was a ghastly one, and the wound really didn't really heal until about the time after Napoleon got done with his exploits. He added the, as it were, the, what do they call it, the coup d'etat, or the coup de grace, the final shot in the head to this thing. But nonetheless, the thing, it didn't kill the beast. The thing continued. Continued for how many more heads? Two. There were seven heads. There weren't eight heads, remember. There were just seven. All of these beasts only have seven. Some try to imply there's eight, but there's, he counts all states, there are only seven heads. And this head that was wounded and was healed was the wound that was inflicted by the Reformation. Mother Russell starts it really at Wycliffe's time. But that wasn't too much of a wound. It really became a nasty one about the time Luther started his work. And it was a very ghastly one about that time. And it was thought to, everyone thought that would be the end of religion in general, be the end of the papacy's power and temporal affairs. But it didn't result that way. Now, the reason why this beast wasn't finished off, because this beast had power to continue for 42 months. That was predetermined, that this beast should have that. Well, a woman was in the wilderness. It was predetermined that she should be there, fed for 1260 days or years. This beast was to receive power for 42 months. Now notice too, they ask a question here in the fourth verse. You know, everyone worshiped the dragon, and they also worshiped this beast. And they said something which is rather remarkable. They said, "Who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him?" No one. Power was given this beast to wear out the saints of the Most High God. No one could make war with her. But don't forget this verse, because someone finally does arise that does make war with this beast, and he conquers it. Now, they ask the question, and the answer is given in the 19th chapter of Revelation. The final answer of who is able to make war with this beast and conquer it. They don't answer it in this part here. But we get the answer later. You see, all these things begin to relate one to the other. There's a chain of the length of our chain grows longer, and I think it grows stronger as we begin to relate these matters one to the other. Well, now, does that mean when the 42 months were ended, that would be the end of the papacy and that would be the end of its power? Is that what the lesson concludes? It says that power was just given to us for 42 months. What would we conclude from that? Would that be the end of her power? I think not. The picture shows very clearly that the papacy continues much beyond that. But that was, as it were, the zenith of her power. That was the heyday, the glory day of this beast in temporal powers. But Brother Russell never taught that that was the end of the papacy after 1260 years, and that from 1799, why, that's the end of the beast, and we won't see any more of it after that. In the same volume, volume 2, Brother Russell says, I'll read the whole paragraph, but ancient pagan Rome and Babylon had only a mere skeleton of sacerdotal power as compared with the complex and elaborate machinery and contrivances of doctrine and practice of papal Rome. The triumphant successor to their scheme, who now, after centuries of cunning and skill, has its power so entrenched that even today, when its power is outwardly broken, and it's shorn of its civil dominion, it rules the world and controls kingdoms secretly, undercover, more thoroughly than the Roman emperors ever ruled the kingdom, the kings subordinate to them. That's Brother Russell, page 289, first paragraph. That's a good quotation to remember, because sometimes we hear quotations from Brother Russell's writings that are really taken out of context to show that That's the end of all temporal power, and from that point on, that's the last we expect to see of any influence and authority from this church, from this beast in civil power. But Brother Russell says that it has, even though it's shorn of its dominion, it has more power in the temporal affairs than some of the greatest emperors that rule the world in hitherto days. Well, going on, in the seventh verse, we read more about this war. Will somebody read, starting with the seventh verse, through the tenth, seven and including ten.
And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints.
Yes. Now notice this beast, it was given unto him to make war with the saints. And how do we understand that giving? You think the Lord blessed them and said, well, go ahead and make war on the saints? Is that how the gift was given? Or just what do we understand by it being given unto him to make war with the saints? He was allowed. He was permitted. That's the thought we understand from this word given. Not that this beast had the Lord's blessing in this by any means. But rather, the Lord allowed this beast to make war with the saints, and Daniel corroborates a similar picture to this when he describes that dreadful beast in Revelation. And Daniel, what does he say? Power was given unto this beast to do what? To wear out the saints of the Most High God. It was granted to them to wear out the saints through the centuries. They've been wearing out the saints. You know, he said, who could make war with this beast? Well, some saints did. But they were, there the saints were really at war with the thing. Not in a literal war, but in spirit. They were antagonistic to this idea of the papacy being in the civil powers of earth. And they made war with it, but they were worn out. They were overcome by this beast. They weren't in harmony with it. There was a fight on. They get the conflict between the Christ here and the Antichrist, between the papacy and the true Christ. The saints were under fire. They were in a position where they were on the losing side, as it were. Not actually, we know they were victorious in death. But nonetheless, from all physical circumstances, from all outward appearances, the saints were the ones that were losing the battle down through the age. They were being worn out by this beast that had power to overcome them. Well, all right, we'll continue where we left off. See if we can't have a little bit more of this chapter tonight. Now, one of the purposes of this beast, and we're told in the eighth verse, it says, and all that dwell on the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. See, the saints were the ones that were making war with this beast, or whom the beast was making war of. They wouldn't worship it. And on top of that, all the others would. In other words, they would recognize the papacy in civil power, at least for the 1216 years. And then it says, he that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity, and he that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience of the saints. This is a word of encouragement to those saints that were being worn out in their struggle with the Antichrist down through the age and with this papacy. And that is their word of encouragement to the saints. And now, from this point, we have another introduction of another beast in the picture, which is, see, so far we've always been dealing with is the historical aspects of the Roman Empire. For the last two meetings, it's always been dealing with its history, and yet we say that Revelation is prophetic, and that no one can understand prophecy before the time, when really a great part of the controversy is over the historical part, which we should be able to see relatively clear, because it is mostly clear and past. Now the next beast, I think we ought to have a picture of it, and then we'll read the account. Don't smile. It's not too friendly a beast either. You notice the fire in his eyes. He's not a little lamb exactly. All right. We'll read verses 11 through 14. Somebody read that, please. If you will, Charles.
And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exercised all powers of the first beast before him, and caused the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth, and in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth, by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live.
Thank you. Now here, notice the consistency of the picture. I think Revelation is beautiful in its consistency in which it goes at things. It started out by talking about a beast rising out of the sea and standing on the sea of the shore. It was standing on the seashore with an earthly picture showing the temporal power. Now here is another beast. Where does it come? It comes up from the earth. The other came up from the sea. It came into being when Rome was restless and turbulent, when the powers of the emperors were decaying. Why, even at the time, as we mentioned before, when Constantine was about to ascend the throne, there were six other possibilities beside him. So you can see the decay that was taking place in the empire. Restless, unstable. But this beast rises up out of a stable element of society. And it doesn't go up to heaven or anything. This shows this beast as a power in the earth, and that means in the temporal affairs of the earth, and their earthly kingdom, as it were. All right, now this beast had two horns like a dragon. I think the Diglot just says horns like a dragon, but then I think the Sinaitic substantiates the two. So it really isn't too important, but I rather think the Sinaitic is correct, that the two horns there, as Brother Russell suggests, who remembers what he suggests? What do the two horns represent? The horn is a symbol of power.
Mr. Beaton and Ireland?
Yes, it represents the divided power, as it were, between the two, the Church of England and Ireland, and the Church as regards really the civil, the temporal power. They exercise considerable sway in the temporal affairs of England and Ireland. Although the religious part isn't being ruled out, but the picture is concentrating more or less on this particular aspect. All right, this beast, it had two horns like a lamb. It was gentle, you know. Didn't have such a ferocious appearance as the other. And yet, it spoke, like a dragon. Who is the dragon? See, it goes back to the false pastor. Spoke like the emperors. It spoke just like the emperors of the Roman Empire, the civil authority. It had the same voice, same authoritative voice as the voices that would speak up on behalf of civil Rome. And additionally, not only did he have a mouth that speaks great things, but he exercised power. He exercises all the power of the first beast which was before us. Does that mean that this beast goes out of the picture? As soon as this beast rises on the scene, is that the thought? It exercises all the power of the beast that was before it. It exercises all the power of the papacy which came before this. And that, therefore, the papacy is out of the picture now? Is that the thought? That's right. This beast doesn't go out of the picture by any means. Matter of fact, it says that this, a two-horned beast, it has power to do miracles in the sight of this beast, of the leopard-like beast. So that just reminds you that the leopard-like beast is on the scene, and he's looking on. And he's very much on the scene, looking on what this two-horned beast is doing. He was doing it in the sight of the beast. That is, he was doing it in the sight of the leopard-like beast. So when this is introduced, it isn't for the idea of overshadowing the leopard-like beast by any means. We're just getting an additional part of the story here. In other words, we're getting all the background. This is all going to lead up to something. And the Revelator is, just like before. Before we explain a situation, sometimes we say, well, now, before I tell you what happened, what's going to happen, I want to tell you the background of events. And that's just exactly what the Revelator is doing. Before he tells us of the things that are yet to come, he wants to tell us first of the background that lead up to the events that are to come. And that's what we're going over here, which we'll have to tie all this in to a solid thread of thought later. It says he exercises all the power of the first beast which was before him. That is, he has similar power to the papal power. That is, in the temporal affairs, this beast had similar power, not necessarily equal power. That isn't so much a thought, but it had similar power, power like this first beast in civil authority. And it had did the same thing that the papacy did, you know, when the papacy emerged, why all the earth, everyone bowed down and worshipped it. And when this two-horned beast emerged, came on the scene up out of the earth, why everyone is willing to worship it. And he also had the power to do great wonders, so that he made fire come down from heaven on earth, in the sight of men. In other words, they claim and exercise the same fiery judgment that the papacy had. You know, when they condemned something, it was condemned, and they could persecute it. They could, we can see in England and in Ireland the same persecuting power that the church possessed in some respect as the papacy had. It was they that, persecuted many of the faithful martyrs, even though some of the persecutions that the English Church perpetrated really help Protestantism in the world, but nonetheless, they had the power to persecute and to bring down fiery judgment upon those who would not fall in line with the two-horned beast. And it also had deceptive power. The same deceptive power apparently as this beast here that had all the cunning of the four universal empires in it. This beast too has the deceptive power, the power to deceive mankind by means of those miracles which it had power to do in the sight of the leopard-like beast. But now this beast is really introduced to introduce another beast, an image of the beast. It's getting a little more complicated now, where one thing is emerging into another very rapidly. Only about three or four verses of introduction to this beast, and that in turn introduces to us another one. So we've got to keep on our toes here and watch the changing events as they develop. All right, now this, we better read from the 15th to and including the 17th verses, and I'll turn off the 16th. Will somebody read that, please? Volunteer.
And the excellent in life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast that should both speak and guard, and as many as did not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And because this law, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bound, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, and that no man might buy or sell, save he who had the mark, or the same by the name of the beast, or the number of his name.
Yes, now this two-horned beast, the Church of Ireland and England, and in the temporal affairs of those countries, have power to create an image to this papacy. Now, who would want to create an image to that? The two-horned beast apparently did. It's an awful thing to want to create another thing like it, but they did. Now, this image of the beast isn't like the leopard-like beast that we're referring to here, in the sense that it has seven heads and ten horns and all that. That isn't the likeness so much. But it's a beast that has all the cunning, all the deceptiveness, all the avariciousness, all the evils, as it were, of this leopard-like beast. This the Church of England says, well, let's create something like it. We'll create an image to this. And we'll create it in the Protestant world so that it'll exercise power in the earth like this leopard-like beast, which will fashion this image of the beast after. All right, that's not a very noble thought, but that's the thought that this two-horned beast had nonetheless. They were going to create an image to this awful leopard-like beast. And not only did he have, notice in this account, something that's very interesting. First, it says it has power to create. That's one power. It says, let us make. He had power, in the 14th verse, he says to them that dwell on the earth. Okay? Again, the picture is an earthly picture. They want this image of a beast to exercise earthly power. They says, let's say to those that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast which had the wound of a sword and did live. Okay? They have that power to say, let us make, or that they should make. People to the earth. Now, they have the power to inspire that thought, to make a power similar to the papacy in Protestantism in the affairs of earth. And not only did they have power to, as it were, suggest the creation, but something additional. What else did they have? They had the power to give it life. Now notice, a long period of time could emerge, or could follow between the time that they said, let us, make this image of a beast, or suggest that others help them in making it, and the time that it is given life. It's just like in the creation of Adam. Remember, God formed Adam out of the dust of the earth? That was one thing. It doesn't say that immediately he breathed in his nostrils the breath of life. We don't know that that was true. It might have been a period of time in which there was just a body created before the Lord breathed into it the breath of life. And when the Lord breathed into it the breath of life, then Adam stood up and he lived. But this image of a beast apparently is created, but it doesn't have any life. Until the two-horned beast says, let's give it life. Now you see, to me, that's a very thrilling part in the study. How accurately the scriptures portray these matters. We see that there's been a long period of time that has elapsed since the creation of the first Protestant Evangelical Alliance, which is represented here by the image of the beast, and its counterpart now is in the World Federation of Churches. A long period of time followed its creation till the time that it was given life. And the record doesn't say that it was going to be given life as soon as it was created. It doesn't say a word about when. It just says, and I'll tell you something, it has power to give it life. It doesn't say when it gives it power. See? I think that's, to me, that's a thrilling aspect in this study, to show how accurate the scriptures are and how hidden in these passages we see the Lord has kept these things just for the right time. It is an easy mistake to make to think that, well, as soon as it's created, it has life. That's natural. But it isn't that way at all. We see that the image was created, but it didn't have any life. It didn't have any real power. But this two-horned beast has power to give it life so that the image should do four things. Not just give it life, it tells you what kind of life it's going to give it. That's another significant thing about this record. It doesn't generalize, it tells you four things specifically that this two-horned beast has the power to make the image do. And what are those four things? Well, it has one, it gives it life so that the image should do what? Speak. Alright, that's one power. It has the power so that this image that is given life can stand up and speak. Speak like the dragon. The papacy, the image of the beast. It could speak like the papal beast. Alright? That's one thing. What's the next thing? Yes, it has power to kill. And that, of course, is symbolic. We don't understand killing here to represent actual killing, no more than the burning of the tares represents actual killing. But it has power to ostracize as Christians. Power to kill as Christians in the sense that if they don't recognize you as a Christian, you will not have Christian liberty. That's the thought. They have the power to say whether you're a Christian, you're a live Christian, or you're a Christian that don't count. In other words, a communist wouldn't be bothered in this because he doesn't want Christian liberty. He wouldn't be killed. He's already dead as far as the church is concerned, see? But a Christian who wants Christian liberty, well, this would be an important thing. He'd want to be recognized as a Christian. But this beast has power that they know he will not recognize you as a Christian. And power to kill, ostracize. That's the idea. They don't recognize you as a Christian. All right, that's the second thing. All right, then what's the next thing?
cause all to receive a mark in their right hand and their forehead.
Yes, he has power to designate. You've got to get the mark of this image of the beast that the two-horned beast has power to give life to. And when it gives life to it, exercises these four authorities in the earth. It has power to designate. You've got to have our mark. Otherwise, we don't recognize you as a Christian. You're off to something. All right, and the last thing is it has, that if you don't have the mark, what's going to happen? The fourth thing.
You can't buy or sell.
We won't recognize your right to buy or sell, and the spiritual market will cut you off. And you notice, this image, it has power to exercise power where? In heaven or earth? The whole picture is here on earth, you see. It's creating an image like this leopard-like beast, which is in the earth, in temporal power. This image of the beast is created not to reign in heaven, in the spiritual realm, so much the picture is here as a temporal power in the earth. And when it's given life, it's more than just I recognize the Church of England saying, well, we recognize the Protestant clergy and so on. Nice, we'll cooperate with them and so on. But in the giving of life, it gets so much life that it has power to do four things. That's what the record says. It says that it has power to speak. It has speaking power. It has killing power. It has designating power. And it has prohibiting power. That's a lot of power that this beast gets when it gets life from the two-horned beast. But the story doesn't end here. This is still historical. We still haven't, this chapter is still telling you of events that are leading up to events that were yet to come to, the important part. Although this part here, I think, is the concluding part of our lesson, is not so much historical as it is bringing it up to the present day. We get up to the point now where we say it's today. We're getting to the point where we understand that the Church of England is beginning, as it were, having already created and urged the inhabitants of the earth to make a likeness of the image of the beast in the earth, that is, a world federation of Protestant churches, an evangelical alliance of all Protestants, for what purpose? So that they can exercise power in the earth. That's what's behind all this federating and all this evangelical alliances of the past. They're interested in exercising temporal power in the earth. That's what's behind it all. And we've already seen the two-horned beast say, let us make this image. And we've already seen the first step in the vitalization of this image of the beast. You know, up until recently, the Church of England would not recognize any other ministers as preachers. They believe the same thing that the Catholic Church does. And what is that in regard to this one matter? What does the Catholic Church teach in regard to its teachers? Yes. That is, only those who follow in the apostolic order the succession of the Church, to one lays the hand on the other, from the apostles' day, from Peter, and who was the first pope, and then Peter laid his hands on another pope and so on. They laid it one on top of the other up until the time of the present. That's apostolic succession. And the Church of England claims to be, have had this blessing, you see, in this apostolic succession. And consequently, because they have been blessed by the apostles, only those who they in turn bless have really apostolic authority to teach. All others are wrong. They're not really ministers because they don't have apostolic authority. How could anyone preach without apostolic authority, which only they have? Well, That matter has been a little bit changed of recent years. At the last World Federation of Meeting, who was the presiding bishop at the Federation meeting? Does anyone remember? Yes, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the chief, what do you call him, exarch? Anyway, he was the chief man in the Church of England. He was the one that was the presiding bishop, and near as we can tell, the Church of England has given its full blessing to the Federation of Churches. But we haven't seen in the past the Federation receiving the life that is explained here. This thing has power so that it's just not a life, you know, a half-hearted thing, but apparently when it gets life, it has power to do certain things. It has power like the papacy, it has power like the two-horned beast, it has power in its own right in the earth as a temporal power. Up till now, we haven't seen the Federation of Churches exercising anything near the power that the other beasts before it exercised in temporal matters. Recently, of course, we see more indications of it, but we believe, as Brother Russell expressed in the forewords of his volume, that there was a future fulfillment of this. Now, it's true that you will find articles by Brother Russell where he suggested very early that, well, maybe it's got all the vitalization that it needs in years gone by, that has to all be qualified by Brother Russell's 1916 writings, in which he positively states where he looks forward to a future fulfillment, which apparently modifies, in a sense, the other things that he has written with regard to his expectations. He was still looking for more, and that was in 1916. Even though he saw the end was near, he still didn't see in his mind the fulfillment of this revelation system. And of course, we have to add the added dimensions of 40 or 50 years into this picture, which Brother Russell didn't see, which allows yet for this image of the beast to exercise the four powers that it is supposed to exercise as the other beasts exercised when they came to power. Well, now, are there any questions up to this point?
Just how did the Church of England, I mean, what did they have to do with starting the Federation? That scripture that says that they had the power to.
Well, they said it says he had power to give life to the image, but it says, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live. In other words, it was their suggestion. Now, historically, I just don't remember just how they went about it offhand. Maybe somebody else remembers just how that happened. I don't know exactly what part the Church of England had in the early stages of the Evangelical Alliance. But from this record and from Brother Russell's account, we just assumed to follow up Brother Russell said, and I never checked on the details. Maybe somebody else has a comment on that. I mean, that's such an accepted part of our Bible students' understanding of Revelation that I just never questioned it, although I'm sure that there is an answer to it. Maybe there is something in the comments on it. Maybe we'll have to check into that sometime and find out just to what extent the Church of England said to those that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast. They did it. We just have to find out where in history that's corroborated.
That would be in 1844, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's when the Evangelical Alliance was formed. Somewhere in there, Whether they said it a little before the thing happened, we don't know, but apparently it was, they must have had their finger in the pie somewhere along the line. Yeah. Well, we'll have to check into that if somebody picked up a piece, Brother Kenneth.
I remember he told me that he was Angelico Linus. Federation of Protestant churches, so there was no movement at that time. Then the American Federation of Churches was formulated in 1908, which brother Russell was more encouraged from even the formation of the Evangelical Alliance. But I don't think the worldwide federation took place until the World Council of Churches, which came into being in 1948. And at that time, Archbishop Fisher, the head prelate of the Church of England, presided, and at the time he said that the World Federation of Churches is no longer in the process of being formulated, it is a reality. Some look upon that as the Church of England getting taller, like the beast or the image of the beast.
Thank you. Is there any additional thought on this question? Somebody remember something on it? I really don't offhand. I just accepted the Evangelical Alliance, as Brother Russell stated, but we of course know that a lot of water has gone over the dam since that time, and certainly we see in the World Federation of Churches something far more significant, far more influential with the, actually the Protestant world has second wealth to the papacy itself. It has tremendous resources and wealth behind it. Protestant revenue in this country alone last year was enough to stagger the imagination. I mean, it's something like $3 billion, not including the church payments that they're making. So you can see that there's tremendous wealth in the Protestant world. And the idea behind this is that they want to use this power. Let's remember the picture. It's exercising it in a temporal way, like the other beast. It isn't just confined in a literal spiritual realm, you see, but rather it's a beast that apparently has its powers in earthly matters, and that's what they're headed for, more and more. Any other questions?
In the 17th verse, it says that the tongues of the beast have the power to prevent the blind showing.
Well, of course, that was an early comment. I don't know what year it was made. That comment was second volume? Well, maybe that is in the second volume. There is an application where Brother Russell does say, and it's a proper one in a sense, that from these Protestant groups, there has been a prohibiting influence. In other words, they're not recognizing the right of us as Christians to merchandise in spiritual matters. It's not so much the truth, because they don't have that merchandising ability themselves, but I think the thought is more that in dealing with the things that apply to the spiritual realm and spiritual matters, that they have the power to prohibit that you couldn't buy or sell, as it were, in the spiritual market. That's the power that they had to prohibit. And there was a sense in which Brother Russell did apply it, that we can't speak in their pulpits, and we can't, they don't recognize us in their church circles and so on. In a limited sense, those things were true. There are usually two applications and sometimes more of the scripture. Sometimes you'll find that Brother Russell makes a general application. And this is a case where he does. And he does apply this in a general way throughout the harvest where we're not recognized and so on. But that wasn't Brother Russell's complete thought. You'll find in the forewords of the volumes where he anticipated more real opposition, so that we couldn't buy in the spiritual market. He expected the Protestants and the Catholics to get together and to, he says, to rule the world with a high hand. Those were Brother Russell's expectations. So you have to, in other words, take Brother Russell's whole viewpoint and understand what he treats sometimes in a general way and what he looked for in the way of a specific detailed fulfillment of prophecy.
Well, Brother Gene, I noticed that. What was another implication there is that they have power to prevent the binding of the telling or the change of spiritual doctrine. That answers that question better than in other words, there are those churches that think that we have no right to live in the spiritual doctrine.
Yes, that's right. We're, as a group, we're frowned upon anyway. Of course, we know that, but it still hasn't prevented our ministry. I mean, that's the realistic part that we have to remember, even though, well, we never did have any part in the churches. We were invited to come out. We're not too anxious, really, to get in their pulpits and so on, unless they invited us to give a public witness, but it's not that we want to belong. All we want to do is preach the truth, and we have been able to do so unhindered, truthfully, in this country, and most of Europe, too. Even now, they have large parts of liberty, and it was only in certain areas for a brief while under Hitler and Mussolini that they were restrained considerably, but it wasn't so much from the Protestant Federation of Churches. It was largely from the papacy and the Hitler regime that prohibited them, not the image of the beast so much, if any at all. So our liberties have been really unrestrained. I think we've got more golden opportunities than any. We can get on radio and television with the rest of the churches, and no one questions our right to do that. We can put out tracts, and we can do everything that we've been able to do all through the harvest. Now, truthfully, if we want to take this thing specifically and say that, we've heard the image speaking, trying to prohibit us, we really haven't even heard them do that as a consolidated voice. We've heard one minister here and one minister there, but we don't hear the Protestant Federation of Churches coming out warning the world against Russellism or something like that, although certain preachers have done it. So I think if we take all of what Brother Russell wrote on this subject, we will look for an additional fulfillment to the general fulfillment that has been given. I think that that's an honest appraisal of Brother Russell's writings. We don't want to misrepresent Brother Russell's thought, but I think if we study everything that he has written, I'm sure that we'll all be forced to the same conclusion, that he looked for certainly greater fulfillment than what has taken place in the past. Of course, we can't take time to refer to all the articles that Brother Russell has on that. That really isn't the purpose of this meeting. Remember, we started out to get a concept, and I think most of us are familiar enough with Brother Russell's writings to know whether that rings right or whether it doesn't. And I think, in this instance, I think we'll all agree that that's pretty much the viewpoint that Brother Russell has. Brother Charles.
What is meant by the number of his name?
Yes. Well, the thought is here. You notice the way this reads, you've got to have the mark of the beast, that is, this leopard-like beast, or the image. You've got to receive designation from one or the other. If you're a good Catholic, you're all set. You have no trouble. if you're a Protestant, it's all right. You've got the designation from the image of the beast. You have, and if you're a Catholic, you have the number of the beast. See? You have the filia, how do you pronounce that? Filia, I got it here, the title of the Pope, that's the number of the beast. Yeah, thank you. Somebody here knows Latin. Here it is. Vicarius Filii Dei. And if I had a blackboard here, I could show you how we get the figures on that. The Vicarius. The V stands for 5, the I stands for 1, the C stands for 100, the A has no numerical value, the R has no numerical value, the I has a numerical value of 1, the U in the Latin was also a V, which would have a numerical value of 5. Filii, that's the next word. The F has no value. The I has a value of 1. The L has a value of 50. The I has a value of 1. And the I has a value of 1. That's Fili. F-I-L-I-I. And then the E has a value, the D has a value of 500. And the I has a value of 1. And the numerical, Roman numeral evaluation. So that gives you a total of 666, which is the title of the Pope, Vicarius Filii Dei. There are other ways of figuring that too. But
may I ask for you that information about the largest compass, reprint compass?
I think there is a reprint on it somewhere. But I picked up this from Brother Loomis, who in turn picked it up from somewhere else. I don't know where it is. But it isn't anything unusual. You will? Yeah.
Yeah, I heard about
it
before.
Yeah, well, that's nothing new. I think it's in a reprint. I remember reading that in an article too somewhere. Mr. Alpha.
In connection with this vitalization, do I get the thought that it was vitalized in a small sense
and
that it has a small beginning, but that it doesn't have full life to do these four things?
It hasn't received the life, apparently, to do these four things yet. I mean, it may have been given the life, but it isn't exercising that, the results of that life. In other words, it's just like when Adam was created, he had power to name the beast and so on. He was king. Well, he didn't exercise all of that the minute he started breathing. See, he did that work later as a as a result of his being vitalized as a man. Then he went through the garden and he dressed it and he named the animals, so on. Well, these are the things that the image will have power to do after it is vitalized. Now, as to how much vitalization it's going to need to do this, we don't know. We're always taking the minimum vitalization as the starting point. Now, maybe England will give it more vitality yet. I don't know. We don't know just how things will emerge, but we know England has done sufficient. The Church of England has recognized other Protestant ministers, and that's practically an outright admittal of the fallacy of the apostolic succession, because if they were true to themselves and their beliefs, they certainly could not recognize anyone who did not have apostolic succession as a minister. That's terrible. But they do it now, see, which is a betrayal of their position.
I think you might want to run this thing out of reason. You might point that up, the fact that England invited Billy Graham, the Church of England invited Billy Graham to the United States, and he's both in the country.
That's right, and the Church of England was instrumental in persecuting Baptists and others before. So The ones whom they persecuted are the same groups now that they're willing to cooperate with. That's a very good point. Thank you. But these are things, brethren, that we want to keep our eye open for. Now, that's the idea of the study of these things. It's not to try to put everything in the past, but let's try to trace this matter up to the present time, which we believe we have done. And we have seen certain indications that Brother Russell alerted the Lord's people in the forwards and in others of his writings in the reprint to be on the alert to a vitalization of this image to the point where it's going to have these suppressive powers in temporal affairs so that they can use great pressure upon the Lord's people. But you see, this doesn't end the story either. Sometimes we're too quick to close the chapter and say, well, that's it. The image federating, and they get such power that nobody can buy or sell, and that's the end of it. See, we can't buy or sell, and that'll be the end of the church, and when we come to that point, we're finished. But the story doesn't end here. It doesn't stop here at this chapter. It goes on in the next chapter, which we'll consider in our next lesson. It tells you about those who received the mark of the beast and got the number of his name and who worshiped the image. What happens to them? And it tells you what happens to those who refuse to get the mark of the beast and the number of his name. They get the victory over the beast. Now, that's the first victory that the saints have gotten in this account, too. Up till now, they've been losing the battle. I mean, from the standpoint of the prophetic writer, he shows them being worn out and killed and ostracized and everything else. But finally, we see the tide of battle turn in the 15th chapter of Revelation, which we'll get into. We'll see what happens after that. But before we get into that, I think our next lesson is going to be on the 17th chapter. We'll rest the image of the beast, and we'll rest the two-horned beast and the leopard-like beast, and we want to get on in our next lesson to the scarlet-colored beast. In other words, we got to get all these beasts and the history of them in clear mind before we deal in the things that are yet to come, as it were, the future fulfillment of Revelation. Well, is there any question now on this, up as far as we've gone?
Concerning the number of his name, in the 18th verse, that seems to be an explanation of just what this has reference to, just as you had explained it, describing the title which is applied to the Pope. Now, would this be a further clarification of that?
Yes, I think that this is a strong hint as to what's implied here. It says, here is wisdom. We didn't read this last verse. Let him that hath understanding, which would be you and me, we should have some understanding. He says, count the number of this beast. You all do have understanding of doing that. Go ahead, count it. Count it up. For it's the number of a man. Nothing spectacular. It's the number that a man has. And his number is 600, 3 score. That's 6. Tells you that very, very plainly, and it identifies it with the Antichrist, with the Pope, and that counterfeit system. And if you have this mark, if you have the number of this beast, if you have the designation from the Federation of Churches, you're all right. Either. Or even if you're a communist, this doesn't bother you. You don't want Christian liberty. Hey, a good communist, he isn't worried about this, or an atheist, any of these people. The only people that this will affect are real Christians that want the right as Christians to perform their function here on earth. Isn't that right? They're the only ones that are going to suffer as a result of this federation of churches doing these four things and the beast with them. The others don't care. They don't want Christian liberty. What is it to the communists if they can't preach Christ and Him crucified and the glory of the kingdom? And the atheists, they don't have the interest in those things. The only ones that are affected are the true Christians, the true saints. They're the ones that want the privileges of the saints. Well, our time is a little overpassed, so we'll just rise maybe without a hymn. And we'll ask Brother Wiener to dismiss this meeting with prayer.